everyone. Welcome to another installment of the Historical Society of the New York Courts podcast series. Today, we're starting a new series called Chatting with the Authors of Judicial Notice. For those of you who don't know, Judicial Notice is our annual publication where we put our mission of preserving, promoting, and protecting New York's legal history. And we're joined today by a few of our authors. I'm Eric Vandervoort, the Society's Communication Strategy Fellow. I've been with the Society for a few months now, helping them with outreach and doing all kinds of good projects. And this is one of the ones that I'm really excited about, where we get to dive into some of the work that we do every day. Today is March 1st, 2024, and we're going to be discussing two articles about Justice Benjamin Cardozo. One about a previously unpublished Cardozo speech, the other about a Cardozo case and a jurist recollection about his quick wit with the authors, Hank Greenberg and Professor John Barrett. Hank Greenberg is a shareholder with Greenberg Traurig and a past president of the New York State Bar Association. Hank currently serves as the chair of the Commission to Reimagine the Future of New York's Courts, counsel to the New York State Commission on Judicial Nomination, and in our house, he is the vice chair of statewide programming for the Historical Society and is one of our trustees. Professor Barrett is the Benjamin Cardozo Professor of Law at St. John's University. He's the Elizabeth S. Lena Fellow at the Robert Jackson Center, and he's a trustee emeritus of the Historical Society of New York Courts and remains an active and engaged participant in much of our programming and work. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Same here.
So we're going to get started with, you've both done really great pieces for Judicial Notice about Justice Cardozo, but for most of our listeners and readers, I think they'll be familiar with the justice, but it's helpful to just know a little bit about him and his background and why it's so important that we keep revisiting his history because he's such an impactful figure. So John, do you want to maybe help us just understand why is Justice Cardozo so important?
Well, he was the chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals at the time when the Empire State really was the leading state, and it was the leading common law court in the country. And during his time as a New York jurist, he led a court that was a largely unified court that built bodies of law and moved doctrine forward in various areas that really shaped the development of this country from the end of the 19th century, which was his young adulthood, into the 20th century, which was his judicial career. So Cardozo left some very big footprints. He also was not just a New Yorker. I mean, he was a New York City boy and a New York City lawyer, a Columbia Law School product, et cetera, and then an Albany-based jurist. But later in life, to his regret, really, he got stuck with promotion to the U.S. Supreme Court and so moved to Washington in 1932 and served on the court from 32 until his health failed in 1938.
And Hank, Justice Cardozo is known for sort of an impact, not just through his jurisprudence, but sometimes his writing, his style, his sort of the, not just the substance, but the way that he brought his presence to the law and to the world. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Benjamin Cardozo's reputation lives with us today, not only because of his writings as a judge of the Court of Appeals, influential though they are, still cited, still taught in law schools today, but equally because of his extrajudicial writings, speeches, which were largely published in a trilogy of books, the most famous of which is The Nature of Judicial Process. So lectures that he gave at Yale and at Columbia and elsewhere, he would later publish in book form. And those publications, many people think, is the paradigm of judicial self-analysis. One of the first judges, along with Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., to boldly and frankly recognize that the common law decision-making process involved jurists making law based not just on logic, but experience and a whole range of factors.
So, and I think that's a good transition into the first piece. So we're gonna begin with John's article. Okay. So do you mind, and we encourage our readers to go in and read these because you really have to see the text and live with these. And the Judicial Notice articles are available on our website, history.nycourts.gov. And we strongly encourage folks to go in there. But if you can give people just the elevator pitch about kind of what you were writing about.
Sure. I'm writing about a little story that I found in a document that was a line allegedly uttered by Cardozo. And it's a quip. It's a humorous joke about his colleagues on the bench in Albany on the Court of Appeals. It's playing off the phrase angle of repose, And it was allegedly about a case that involved a construction contract requiring a certain angle of repose. And someone allegedly on the court asked, what's an angle of repose? And Cardozo quipped, come and watch this court at 4 p.m. in the afternoon during oral arguments. You'll see the angle of repose, meaning sleeping judges. It's a curious little line, and it first caught my eye because Cardozo's remembered for so many things, but sort of sense of humor and quipster skills is not really one of them. And so I just started to tug on the thread. I found this reference in a letter in the papers of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson. I'm Jackson's biographer. Jackson was a Cardozo protege when he was a young New York lawyer. And Jackson had received it from a philanthropist in Philadelphia named Jacob Billikopf, who was an incredible networker. He was connected with Jewish charities nationwide and wrote letters prolifically every day and just, you know, sort of passed stories from one correspondent to the other. So he sent this story to Jackson. He reported that he'd gotten it from a New York judge named Lisansky. Edward Lisansky was the presiding justice of the second department, the intermediate appellate court in Brooklyn. And Lisansky was the one who said he'd heard this, it seems, from Cardozo. And so I just started to sort of piece this together. Jackson papers led me to Billikopf papers, led me to Lisansky information, led me to court records, and it checks out. There actually was a case. It's a waterfront case in southern Brooklyn. It involved the building of a bulkhead and a wharf, and the fill was supposed to be set at a certain angle of repose. And so it all just kind of checked out chronologically, and it sort of showed two people in the years after Cardozo was gone, Billikopf and Lisansky, talking about him as if he was the most important, vivid, enduring force. And of course, I think he kind of was. And with this quip, Billikopf has material to share with Justice Jackson, with Justice William O. Douglas, with Charles Evans Hughes Jr. You know, it's sort of a story that spread in some law circles many, many decades ago. And it was fun to revive it and figure out what its context was. That, by the way, was a long elevator ride.
Yeah, well, we're on a very tall building. And in the piece, it seemed to me that there was sort of, I mean, there's a Cardozo clerk network, and there was sort of that it was being shared amongst people, you know, through mimeograph, I guess, at that point, or sort of typing carbon copy stuff. But it did seem that this, when you were looking at the letters, was there sort of any discussion or anything that you weren't able to include in the piece that was sort of like, were people looking at this and were like, Cardozo was actually funny? Or is there anything along
the
line?
I didn't find an editorial comment saying that. It's implicit in the correspondence that's reporting this. What I did find, there's a vast archive of Billikopf letters at the Hebrew Union College archives in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I have done research there and in the Billikopf papers. They're fantastic. And he was a pen pal with so many jurists, including Cardozo himself. And so, you know, the Lisansky, Cardozo, Jackson, all of that material was there. And there's a lot of Cardozo revering, Cardozo voice hearing, Cardozo behavior emulating. He really was this shining, towering figure for all of these successors.
Yeah, and it's sort of demonstrative. You quote in the piece the line, and I'll get it wrong, so I'll ask you to correct me on it. But it's that when he's looking at cases or precedents, it's like he's pulling stars from the sky, and it's kind of this humor is both illustrative of that capacity in him in incorporating that. Do you think that's a correct impression?
He was described, and many people are, but it seems true in his case, as somebody with a photographic memory, and Lisansky was about 6-7 years younger than Cardozo, also coming out of Columbia Law School. And in those days, you became a law clerk or an apprentice, kind of unpaid in a law office for your first year after law school. And so young Ed Lisansky becomes a clerk in the Cardozo Brothers Law Firm in New York City, which is where Albert Jr. and his younger brother Ben together practiced law. And Lisansky remembered, and he reported to Billikopf, it's in one of these letters, that when he was doing some research, he posed a question to young lawyer Cardozo, and said he was having trouble finding some relevant authority. And Cardozo spit out the names of two cases from other states that he had just absorbed and had at immediate recall. And so, you know, he was special in many ways. And now we know he was a humorist too.
And he was a human being, and it really helps to just put some, since we spend so much time.
Cardozo is an interesting life because he's a kind of monastic figure, and he's kind of austere and above or away from his times. He's a bachelor. His life is the law. He's, as Hank described in his lectures, he's really deeply reflective about his legal work and the judicial craft. You don't really think about him having pals or yucking it up or being sort of warm and connected at the personal level, but he was all those things too. And this is a little glimpse of that.
He was well respected by his peers on both courts he served on.
Beloved.
Really tremendous. Anything else you want to add from your piece that I missed?
I have a chair that's named after Cardozo, which is kind of a weight. And so I kind of, with trepidation, sort of dug into this and really was determined to run it down and do it well. And I do have to credit the Historical Society and the editorial process that I was put through to kind of make this turn out well, and hopefully in a way that's worthy to Cardozo.
Oh, absolutely. It's a tremendous little vignette in the life, and it's also really great to learn about the people that were around him and were in his
One last thing. Professor Andrew Kaufman at Harvard Law School, who is Cardozo's great biographer, is, you know, a hero figure and an academic scholarship mentor of mine. I was delighted to be able to email a little bit back and forth with him as I was working on this. And it was a story that he didn't know. And it's at some level a trifling little story, but it was good to be able to check out with a source before I wrote anything about Cardozo.
Yeah, so it's as close as we can get to verifying the event without actually pulling the quote from the justice in his chamber.
Well, but it's really quite direct because the Brooklyn Wharf case came up through Lisansky's court, and Cardozo's court is in effect in part reversing Lisansky's court. So it's easy to imagine shortly thereafter, them having a conversation, angle of repose, the quip about the judges at repose. It does all sort of fit. And by the way, I didn't know much about Edward Lisansky. He was a major legal figure in the appellate division, the AD2, the second department appellate division. The presiding justice, until he hit mandatory retirement, lived a long, accomplished life in the law. So that was a fun little sidelight too.
Yeah, thank you. So Hank, your piece, I mean, John told us that Justice Cardozo was a monastic figure and wasn't necessarily much of a public life guy, although he ran for office and he was in service for, obviously. But your piece is really about what you call his most widely heard and also the lost speech. Do you want to give us the overview of that?
Sure. I just want to, by the way, just say, apropos John's piece, anyone with the remotest interest in Cardozo should read John's piece.
Absolutely.
Because going back to when I was an undergraduate, I think I've read just about everything that's been written about Cardozo. He's been my hero. I wrote my undergraduate honors paper as a senior about Cardozo. And he is, as John said, monastic, is a way of saying almost no one knows anything about the man, the interior Benjamin Cardozo. By the unanimous testimony of all his contemporaries, that's Grant Gilmore's phrase, he was a saint. But humor, never read, never heard. Andrew Kaufman's 500 pages, nothing about the humor of Cardozo. So I think I really found John's piece wonderful and interesting. So my article, you know, Cardozo is not a distant historical figure. It's not as if we're talking about, you know, Cicero or Julius Caesar. This is a man who lived, you know, in the early 20th century into the 1930s as a legal professional. By the early 1930s, he's a demigod in legal circles. I believe he's the greatest common law judge in American history. People can debate that. But his reputation by the early 1930s was so extraordinary that when the great Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. resigned, a Republican president, Herbert Hoover, had little choice but to appoint the Democrat Benjamin Cardozo to the Supreme Court. Of course, he could have done otherwise. But the world, the editorial boards of the world, said only one person could replace Holmes, and that was Cardozo. So everything he said was published. Every expression in the legal world was the subject of discourse. Every lecture in a law school would find its way either into a book or a subsequent publication. Just my years sort of studying Cardozo and reading about him, I had only heard his voice once. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one recording of his voice that's accessible. That's at Columbia University. And I remember when I clerked for Judith Kay shortly thereafter, we were in hunt to hear the voice of Cardozo. So it's a recording of a different speech. So we heard the voice. And then I stumbled across this speech, the one that I write my short article about. And what was stunning about it was I thought I had read every speech Cardozo had given because invariably it was published. And I had not seen this. What really inspired the speech first of all, I discovered that there was a speech when I saw a photo. And it was a photo that was the end of a many-year search that I had had for a picture of Benjamin Cardozo with Franklin Roosevelt. There were, in this period, two larger-than-life governors when Cardozo was chief judge. There was Al Smith, one of the great, some people think the greatest governor in New York history, and then there was Franklin Roosevelt. And he's chief judge. So you think they'd be at a lot of events together. And I always wanted to see a picture of them together. And then I found this picture of Cardozo and Roosevelt sitting together at an event. And I got this picture on eBay. Oh, there it is. There's the picture.
Thank you, Professor.
And it was that picture came from the files of a newspaper, and I don't recall which one, but on the back of it, it described the event and the event and the location. That's Chancellor's Hall, which is a magnificent building, a magnificent room in the State Education Department in Albany. And it referred to a speech that Cardozo and Frankfurter gave. They both gave speeches at the 200th anniversary of the birthday of George Washington. So it was February 22, 1932. I have a picture, and now I need to know more because I had never heard that they had both given speeches. And that led me to Professor Barrett, because Professor Barrett, among other things, no one knows more about Robert Jackson, but also wrote a book about Robert Jackson and Franklin Roosevelt. So I'd say Professor Barrett is in the running for the people who know the most about Franklin Roosevelt, in addition to Jackson, and had a relationship with the FDR Library in Hyde Park, and is also on the board. And Professor Barrett was kind enough to check with the library to see if they had anything about this event, at which Franklin Roosevelt, who was then the governor, was there. And lo and behold, the clouds parted, and they had the invitations for the event. They had the program for the event, and they had the text of the speeches for the event, which at the time, after I had that, I wanted to see whether that speech had been read or published anywhere. And the answer to that question is some newspaper stories covered parts of the speech, as well as FDR's speech the following day. And then the commission created by President Hoover to celebrate George Washington's birthday and the anniversary thereof published its report for all the events around the country. So there was the text of the speech, too. Then I saw in a newspaper article that the speech, Roosevelt's and Cardozo's, was broadcast to a national audience. The celebration was a big deal. And it immediately struck me, the irony, that was without question the speech given by Cardozo heard by the largest number of people, actually heard by the largest number of people. Most of his speeches were at meetings of bar associations or in law schools. I had not heard of Cardozo giving speeches, you know, to vast throngs of people, let alone a national broadcast. And I was struck by the irony. So many people heard the speech, but where is it? Every other speech I'm aware he gave of any significance had been published. And here was a speech that he had delivered with Franklin Roosevelt, who delivered a speech of his own. And then the last sort of stunning thing, I guess, before we talk about the speech he actually gave, was as he delivered that speech, it was 2 days before he went on the United States Supreme Court, right? He was just 2 days away. He was, it's hard to believe today, given what we deal with in terms of U.S. Supreme Court confirmation processes, but from start to finish, from nomination to confirmation, less than 2 weeks for Benjamin Cardozo, which tells you a lot about Benjamin Cardozo. And his reputation. And then it also occurred. So he's 2 days away from his next chapter in life as a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And it also struck me that when Roosevelt, who's in that picture sitting next to him, delivered that speech, that was a month after he announced his candidacy to run for president of the United States against Herbert Hoover. And a year away from being president of the country. So these two men are on the cusp of, in Roosevelt's case, epically historic and important presidency, and in Cardozo's case, on the highest court in the nation.
So you're really capturing a moment right when two great New Yorkers were about to ascend to just this
right
level even beyond, although, of course, we are the Empire State. We are the best of the
Still
states.
Very cool, but, right? Think of that. Those are two of the three awesome branches of government in New York, headed by FDR and Benjamin Cardozo.
Yep. It's a tremendous little moment you have there. And just for the context of our readers, when Hank is talking about the Supreme Court confirmation process, we're looking at now a quick, I think Justice Barrett was about a 60-day process, something like that. We could be looking at 100-200 days for even a fairly smooth process for confirmation. So to go from nomination to that so quickly is really does speak to Justice Cardozo.
Not just duration, but controversy.
Of course.
Cardozo appointment is really by acclamation, by national acclamation.
Yeah, truly, truly impressive. Not something we'd see today, although maybe one day. So Hank, in that you gave us the context for that. Talk about the speech a little bit, about the context, about the actual content of it.
Yeah.
You mentioned in the article that Justice Cardozo has a particular writing style that sort of turns words on their head and things. And when I was reading through it a couple times this week, I really did see some of that. So talk us through some of the speech.
Sure. Well, if no one's ever read anything by Cardozo, if they want an introduction to why people invariably comment on Cardozo's prose style, this is a perfect introduction. And reasonably short. So both in terms of the style and the substance, it's really classic Cardozo. His prose style is unique and a great, historically great writer, but not by measured in terms of, let's say, comparing it to Ernest Hemingway or even Robert Jackson, one of the great judicial stylists. Cardozo wrote, one commentator who was somewhat critical of his prose style referred to it as alien grace, which is effortless, right? Poetry, flowery, but not flowery in a way that seems pompous, but, you know, distinctive in the sense that when you went to college, when I went to college, when John Barrett went to college, somebody would have said, you want to write English prose, here's Strunk and White. Here's how you do it. You got a noun, you got a verb, right? Write in the active voice, do not write in the passive voice, right? All of these rules, right? If you want to write sort of classic 20th century American conception of what prose is, Cardozo took all of those conventions and turned them on his head, right? He routinely wrote sentences in the passive voice. He would invert phrases. He was obviously trying with his prose to capture complex ideas in simple phrases. So very self-consciously, as you read his prose, he's writing Cardozo prose. Anyone who's familiar with him two or three sentences. You don't even have to know it's Cardozo. You would know it's Cardozo. And there are very few people I can sort of think of ever, and I consume a lot of literary fiction, whose style is so distinctive as his. And in that sense, this is a prose poem. He's writing about, it's a homage to George Washington. And he probably knew he was writing for a nationally recorded audience, right? And it's lovely and it's elegant. So that's the style of it. The substance of it, which at least struck me as interesting and different from the times, you'd sort of know, how could you say anything about George Washington at a celebration of his birthday that would be edgy by contemporary standards, right? This has got just got nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court, right? At least today, the nominee would probably be counseled by the White House, do not give any public speeches, right? All you can do is say the wrong thing and trip yourself up. And it's actually in a few places, he says things that I think viewed from a contemporary perspective, I don't want to say is provocative, but I don't think a nominee would say it. Let me give you an example. He actually talks about, the title of the article is Washington, the Constitution Builder. And of course, Washington wasn't an author of the Constitution, right? But he was the president of the Constitutional Convention that produced the Constitution, right? And it was his dignity and his eminence that helped usher that process along. In the course of describing the Constitution, Washington contributing it, Cardozo acknowledges that it's an imperfect document, that there are problems with it, right? Here's the sentence. I'll just read it to you. He says, only talking about the Constitution, only pride and arrogance would dare to say that imperfections will not develop with the centuries, have not developed even now. Only stubbornness and folly would close the eye and mind against them. Well, today, if a justice said that before they got nominated, that's about how many hours of questioning about what is wrong with the Constitution, which parts are, so there was that. There's something, I mean, by the way, I think that's shouldn't be a provocative thing to say, but in a world where we're living with originalism as a jurisprudence, where the intent of the Constitution, at least for some jurists, is the most fundamental thing, how about that? The other thing that he does that's really, at least I find interesting in the course of talking about George Washington, is he's giving this speech right smack in the heart of the Great Depression. I don't know if at this moment the Depression is absolutely at the low ebb, right? I don't know exactly what the unemployment rate was, right? But this is 1932 and FDR is about to become president and we are on the verge of the New Deal and all of those efforts to sort of address mass unemployment and economic dislocation. And Cardozo just says, just been nominated for the Supreme Court, right? He talks about the vagaries of the market, the crash of economic values, the discontent of the hapless, the hates and loves and rivalries of sex and groups and factions. So he's talking about tribalism, right? He's talking about economic disarray, which of course on one level, no brainer. It's the Depression. All of that's happening right now. But again, not the sort of thing you expect to hear from a jurist 2 days away from confirmation for the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So is it the most important speech that Benjamin Cardozo ever delivered? No. Does it say things that have never been said before about George Washington? No. But if I was talking to someone who had never read anything about Benjamin Cardozo and wanted to get sort of the essence of his prose and how he talks about issues in high-minded ways, it's a pretty good start.
Thank you. So two questions that come to mind for me, that one for Hank and then one I'll throw to both of you. I think also in the speech, when you that line you emphasized, particularly about that the Constitution, you cannot look at it as a fixed thing. Cardozo is really in conversation there with an American tradition that's not just in the Washington legacy, but with Jefferson there, right? Because if you think about imagine going to the Jefferson Memorial in DC, and I think it's on the Northwestern wall when you have the Jefferson quote, a man should be asked to wear the coat that he wore as a boy to think about the Constitution as a fixed thing. So there really is this tradition. Have you seen, just in your general reading of Cardozo, that sort of legacy of connecting with more of the founders or sort of those founding principles that he was, you know, really reflective in those spaces, because it's deep in the American tradition.
Well, I think Professor Barrett would certainly know better than I. I'm not aware in 1932 whether there was a well-developed conception of thinking about constitutional interpretation, either in terms of an evolving document relative to a static document for which the original intent was a dispositive part of the inquiry. I just don't know whether that debate existed in 32. And you know, the other interesting thing, and I think Professor Barrett alluded to this, and I don't want to be dismissive of Benjamin Cardozo's career as a Supreme Court justice, but his greatest work was in Albany, in the Court of Appeals, rather than as a U.S. Supreme Court justice, which isn't, his opinions on the Supreme Court are Cardozian, and some of them, like Pafko versus Connecticut, had an afterlife. But, you know, just thinking about the Constitution, last thing I'll sort of say is on the New York Court of Appeals, when he left it, the preeminent constitutional jurist was Irving Lehman, right? He was the guy, right? Cardozo was the common law guy, Meinhard versus Salmon, Paul's Graf. So when he got to the Supreme Court, I don't know that he made a mark jurisprudentially in the sense of, to your question, an expansive, breathing, living constitution, as opposed to one that, you know, what did they think about gun rights in the 18th century?
Yeah, I'll tuck in a little comment. I'm glad Hank mentioned Paul's Graf, because Paul's Graf came from Brooklyn and was an Edward Luzanski case before it was a Paul's Graf case. So it sort of braids together in a little story I wrote about. And I agree completely that Cardozo's greatest judging was in Albany on the Court of Appeals. But in the sort of U.S. Supreme Court years, and on the question of static or evolving constitution, Cardozo wrote the opinions in the Social Security cases in 1937, U.S. versus Stuart Machine and Helbring versus Davis, which upheld the unemployment compensation system and the old age poverty prevention pension system. And in each of those cases, they are spending programs using taxing power and a kind of interactive national federal machinery that's being set up. And Cardozo is writing opinions about how the Constitution permits the legislature to solve modern problems. And of course, that had been a lot of his common law judging. But that's a spot where he's doing it in U.S. constitutional.
And I think that leads right into my second question, which is not related to the pieces, but I think is an interesting transition that we have already discussed, where Cardozo and Roosevelt are both making that leap, right, Hank, as you said, and I think you're correct that 32 roughly is about the, I mean, it certainly wasn't a pleasant time during the Depression, and you could characterize it as like the first wave of the Depression, I think, because we, the New Deal, there were two New Deals, really. And so I wonder, and maybe John, you might have more insight in this, if there is any writing or any reflection on sort of that transition, because Cardozo wasn't appointed as a New Dealer, and FDR, once he was in office, FDR was appointing people who would be good New Dealers precisely because of the challenge of a court that struck down law after law after law until the switch in time. Do we know how Cardozo navigated that dynamic until the switch in time? And do we know kind of what that looked like? Because he was a friend to FDR in that period when everything was being struck down.
FDR had no appointments in his first term. He is stuck with the old court, and the old court is the enemy of the New Deal legislative program from 1933 through 1936. And then FDR proposes court packing and the court shifts. And then justices start to retire and he gets his appointments. And so Cardozo is part of the old court and he's a Hoover appointee on the old court, but he's not obviously one of the four horsemen or the five or six enemies of New Deal legislation. He's in the other camp, if you will. He had a sort of respect for the democratic process and a deference to legislative activity. And so that kind of cuts across. I mean, there are some exceptions. A unanimous court struck down the National Industrial Recovery Act in the Schechter Poultry case. But in some of the divided decisions. Carter versus Carter Cole, for instance, that's a 5-4 decision. Cardozo is one of the four dissenters. So he was sort of, you know, without having the words to put it this way, he was waiting for the appointees who came, sadly, just in the last year of his judging, the 1937 Hugo Black appointment and thereafter.
Okay. You know, Eric, the only thing I'd add, and it's not jurisprudential, it's more personal, and Professor Barrett alluded to this earlier. Cardozo was profoundly depressed when he went to Washington, and it didn't get much better over time. He not only missed the Court of Appeals, his associations, he was very unhappy on the court. There isn't much in terms of his private correspondence. When he died, Irving Lehman burned literally all of his private correspondence that Cardozo had retained. But there are letters that he wrote where he shared with friends his disappointment with the court and where it was at that time before Roosevelt started to make appointments.
Yeah.
Was not accustomed to being in dissent.
And remember that Cardozo's Supreme Court service years were largely before the building existed. So the justices worked out of their homes and their apartments, and it had a kind of solitary exile quality. He was away from New York and so forth. But that actually reminds me, and Hank gets credit for sort of finding this, there's a little collection of letters that he extracted from the Court of Appeals, actually, which has a little pocket of Cardozo letters. And there's a quip in one of them where Cardozo is writing about how the Supreme Court term is about to end, and so soon he'll be able to return from Washington to his native skyscrapers, which, you know, is charming.
That might be your next article to do.
That would be very short. In my piece, Hank's is more interbranch. Mine is intrajudicial. But there really is a kind of judicial collegiality that's an undercurrent in the Lisansky Appellate Division, Cardozo Court of Appeals landscape and interaction. And I think and hope state courts function like that today. But obviously we see the U.S. Supreme Court being a riven body. And I think, you know, that's an unfortunate contrast. I think the days of judges, you know, sitting and falling asleep together and conferencing together, and even when dividing, really functioning together, was something that, you know, through the individuals involved or the times or some combination of forces, we had in Cardozo's day. And that was a good thing.
It's a hopeful example we can keep providing.
Yeah, and all I'd add is it's always refreshing and inspiring to brush up next to Cardozo and his writings. You know, in the 20th century, when you think of great presidents and leaders, you think, okay, in a century, how many can you have? You can have a Churchill, you can have a Roosevelt. In the 19th century, you could have a Lincoln, right? But, and, you know, you shouldn't have an expectation any more than you expect how many Einsteins will physical sciences produce. In the 20th century, we had Cardozo, and we had Holmes, and we had Hand, and we had Jackson, and a lot of others, but that kind of larger than life, he was really that extraordinary. We really, at this moment, and that doesn't necessarily speak ill of our times, right? Because this is once, twice in a century, but he was that. So that's why, I mean, when you see so distinguished and respected historian like John Barrett seizing on the joke, right, and writing an article about it, that is in its own way an extraordinary tribute, right, to the giant that Cardozo was. And, you know, for that reason, it's really wonderful that Judicial Notice published Professor Barrett's piece, and I'm just thrilled that I got to say a few things about really what's Cardozo's speech.
Yeah.
Well, Hank, it strikes me that your article is, in a sense, and this is the echo of Washington, Cardozo's farewell address. You know, he's leaving Albany. It's sort of, not quite, but it's sort of Washington going home to Mount Vernon, or Washington dismissing his troops or something. So there's a nice parallelism there with the subject matter.
Yeah.
That's a
I
great
wish I'd
note.
used that as the title. Because I thought about that before.
You can retitle it when you publish your anthology.
That's tremendous. And I think that's exactly why people continue and will continue to explore Justice Cardozo's legacy and his rich career. And so thank you, gentlemen, so much for your pieces and for joining us today. We are going to be continuing these podcasts for the next few weeks, meeting with other authors who provided pieces for Judicial Notice 18. For all the listeners who, again, we cannot encourage you enough to go and read the articles, read the other articles, read the prior pieces. Hank and John both have prior pieces in there, and they're excellent as well. So you can find out about that at history.nycourts.gov. Again, my name's Eric, and I'm here on behalf of the Historical Society of the New York Courts. Thank you, John. Thank you, Hank.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.